So you didn't know this boy?
No, sir, never seen him.
Hmm. And he just hit you?
Like I said, he asked for my lunch money first. Good thing I brown bagged it.
Well, if you haven't got a finger in Em's troubles, then why did her name get me into your rather exclusive party?
Keep up with me now. I don't know, but it sounded like you did. And a body's got a right to be curious. No, I'm not so sure.
I'll put that body to bed. I don't know a damn thing about whatever troubles, and that works for me.
Hello and welcome to Cavaliers to Cinema for another week. We are stretching the term classic to fit our personal tastes this week because we will be taking a look at Rian Johnson's debut film,
Brick,
2006.
Am I sure? Right? Five? I think it's five.
No, it's six.
Well.
So, yep, pretty recent film. It really does stretch the meaning of the word classic. But
we enjoyed it.
It's so garnered a cult following since, so yeah. I think that qualifies.
And in only a couple of years, the guy's making movies with Bruce Willis, so and quite timely as well.
And directing some fucking awesome episodes of Breaking Bad.
Yes.
So we realise that a lot of you probably haven't seen Brick. It would be the least watched film of everything we've done.
Yeah.
Except maybe The Fountain.
Ha.
So let's give a quick plot synopsis.
Okay, Brendan is a young man in high school, whose girlfriend is, Emily, is murdered. And he's not too happy about that, so he decides to find out what's going on. And he gets in with the drug crowd to find out what happened.
Featuring a crazy cast of characters.
Lucas Haas, which is a good cast.
Yeah,
the pin.
You've got the local drug lord, the pin. You've got the muscle Tug. You've got the femme fatale Laura, Laura. And
at the center of it all, you've got Brendan.
And you've got the brain, who's sort of like the Dr. Brain, Watson of the operation.
Yeah.
So it's basically very noir, like
neo-noir.
We'll get to sort of neo-noir and what we've learned about that. But yeah, it's very noir and not just sort of like playful allusions, hard-boiled story with very genre throwback dialogue, and except it's all set in high school. And it's not too on the nose, but occasionally there are these really nice little hints of sort of the absurdity of the scenario. This isn't necessarily a realist film, but it's not.
It's not a realist film. By any stretch of the imagination.
But it's not a tongue-in-cheek, on-the-nose film. It's quite dark, quite dramatic. Very good. The brick of the title refers to Brick of Heron, which is sort of the main driver of the plot.
Mm-hmm.
We probably shouldn't say any more because that would spoil it.
We're doing a thing on it, so we might. Oh, I suppose.
We'll try and be gentle. We'll try and be gentle. Look, if you really want to avoid, it's not.
It's very watchable. It's not going to be ruined by anything we can say. I don't think
the actual contents of the mystery is not what grabbed me. I mean, I kind of saw the main twist, so to speak, coming.
Yeah.
It's very good. Recommend you see it. If you really want to avoid spoilers, go watch it now. Press pause. Come back, and we'll be talking about it.
It's worth it.
But if not, look, we're not going to completely ruin it for you. So let's get to Brick. Now, first of all, why are we choosing Brick?
Well, I saw this film a little while ago on the recommendation of everybody and anybody who saw it. And like everybody and anybody and everybody who saw it, I loved it because it was very, very cool. And it wasn't bothered by that. And I recommended it to Saro. And he watched it, and he loved it.
Yes,
so,
but there's Vince Gilligan recommended it to me.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
but there's another more sort of commercial reason why.
Oh, yes. Well, the fact is that seeing as Looper
is coming out
very soon.
27th. And no, we haven't been paid by Rian Johnson. He's just an awesome dude.
He's an awesome dude.
Good feelings about Looper.
I have a very good feeling about
Looper. Early critical
reception
is very good. So
yes,
this is our entire podcast with Looper. And also, if you're a Breaking Bad fan, and if you're not, watch that thing. Rian Johnson directed the most polarizing and possibly well-known episode of the series, Fly, which is a sort of the quote-unquote slowest episode of the show, and is very surreal and stylized and sort of existential. And that was in season 3. He came back this year in season 5 to direct the similar but not quite as unique episode 51, which once again slows down the action and deals more with the sort of inner workings of the character's personality. This isn't actually sort of this is a bit of a misrepresentation of Johnson, because he does enjoy his plot momentum and his genre trope. So he was given these scripts, he didn't pick them. So if that is where you know Johnson from, that's not exactly the best example of his work, even though it's very good work. But he, a lot of the sort of unique camera work in those episodes that you might have known shows up in Rick. So Rick, let's go.
I don't know. Oh, just on the making of the movie, it was really impressive the fact that they even got it off the ground. What's going on?
Sorry, this keeps happening. Yeah, go.
Basically, they kind of passed around the hat with like friends and family and stuff. They realized that the minimum they needed to make the film was $500,000. They got it somehow. He talked to Joe Gordon-Levitt, who's really good.
Yeah.
And kind of, you know, he'd done a couple of big things at that point. He was like, going the indie route to kind of get some cred.
This was post Mysterious Skin.
That's true. Well, yeah, no. So he was kind of just still going the indie path just to kind of get some. Yeah, a little bit of credibility.
He was yet to incept or rise.
Or
have his 500 days.
Yeah.
Go on.
But, I think the fact is that it is a very unique script. And I think he spent a long time working on the script.
And he couldn't get anyone to pick it up.
Yeah, exactly. Because it was just so...
I wouldn't fund it.
Fuck no.
Because it's, the dialogue in it is very much this really, It's hard-boiled sort of noir detective dialogue.
Absolutely, and that's the point.
That is the point. It's played very straight, but he says himself, if you did one thing wrong, this would have turned into a bunch of kids doing bad Humphrey Bogart impressions.
Yeah.
And this is why there is no way in hell, and he acknowledged this, you really would want to trust a first-time director handling such a precarious script.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he pulls it off.
He pulls it the fuck off.
He pulls it off.
But, well, see, I think the thing is that, you know, seeing kind of material like that in the hands of anybody is bad enough. But the way he kind of handles like a scene where Brendan meets Tug for the first time, I think that directing is one of the best example in the entire film. Like where
he just gets punched.
Repeatedly. But the camera work just kind of just moves like side to side. And it probably read in the script like Tug punches Brendan. Brendan goes down. Brendan gets back up. Tug punches him again. He goes down. He gets back up. Like, it would have just kind of read, like, a bit stupidly. But the way it's shot, the camera just kind of moves to one side, and then he approaches from that side, and then Tug decks him, and then it goes back,
sucker punch mindset of the fighting style. It's
just really, really, really well done. And the thing is, it embraces the fact, like, when you're seeing that, you're just like, well, this wouldn't happen. This is rubbish. This wouldn't happen. Like, I think that early kind of instance is what sets up the rest of the film. Like, this is fiction. This absolutely is completely stars. It's complete, you know, hogwash.
Yeah.
You're either going to go along with it or you're not.
It's a fantasy sort of...
Absolutely.
It sometimes does draw attention to this, but it does it in nice, subtle ways that don't take you out too much. You can still appreciate the drama of the film while also appreciating this sort of fantasy world that the kids are living in. Exactly. Now, the thing we should probably mention is that we don't know any of the work of Hammett.
Dashiell. Yes, Mr. Dashiell Hammett. We don't. I've read one Raymond Chandler novel and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a few noir films, but, you know, this is very much a throwback to that era. And, of course, it is one of those things that's so sort of absorbed into popular culture. You don't even have to see.
Yeah.
We were going to podcast this with Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, which would have been a nice counterpoint. We didn't end up doing that. But this is an extremely, homage-heavy film.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think the thing is that makes it so special. I mean, it'll be all very well and good to kind of just do an homage to 20s detective movies. That'd be all very well and good, but if you just did it in that style, then there'd be nothing unique about it and there'd be kind of no reason for it existing. The fact that it is in a high school and is so... just exactly as stylized is what makes it special. It's just completely average kind of people just in extraordinary circumstances, and that's what kind of makes it special.
Well, I don't know if they're average people. There's some classic noir art.
Well, Brendan, I think Brendan is...
Brendan's the ordinary. Yeah. But a really interesting, my favorite sort of piece of dialogue that gets used throughout the film is, I know where you have lunch. Do you know where he has a bunch. It's like, yeah, it's a very good high school trope that sort of fits so seamlessly into this noir sort of dialogue that is so impeccable and flawless and flows. And you really have to pay attention because it's very thick dialogue. And yeah, they keep always saying, you know, do you know where he has lunch? Do you?
Yeah,
and of course, you know, in high school, that is sort of how you identify yourself, where you have lunch, you know.
Yeah, like, and also just like...
It's a great combination of the two.
And stuff like when he goes and beats up Dode for the first... He goes and tries to get information from Dode the first time, and turns around to like Dode's buddies and he's just like, hey, potheads, I got all five senses and I slept last night. It puts me six up on the rest of you. Just like,
no, it's
just
not potheads, it's ash heads. It's something like that. You'd never be that
straightforward. It's great, yeah. No, that's so... It's that typical thing of being so quotable but so unquotable because you never get all the words quite right. And it just makes you want to go, yeah, that's badass. But like, oh, wait, what did he say again? Like,
an interesting...
I'm going to say it quick, Rummy. I'm going to say it straight. Who's hiding the hooch? Is some blind turkey jerking suds on the side? Just like...
yeah. Another interesting point of reference for this film in terms of when it comes out. Christian hasn't seen it. This is released a year after Veronica Mars, the television series, debuted. They're very similar.
Sarah's described it to me as Buffy meets Brick, and that sounds very enticing.
Yeah, I think that's
enticing.
A really reasonable... it's sort of very it's enticing. Got the same sort of combination of noir and, you know, the high school, except it's also has this very feminist subtext, and you've got more... themes of class struggle, which is very interesting.
Very fun.
Anyway, if you haven't
like
seen
the
show, you should go see it. But it's a really interesting counterpoint to Brick and this kind of this mini trend. I can't think of any other examples of really taking the noir genre as sort of an exploration of, you know, the old high school is hell, which of course Buffy did by using horror tropes. And in Brick and in Veronica Mars, they go, no, let's use noir to explain this. Except while Veronica Mars is sort of metaphorical, this is literally, it's just noir set in a high school.
And the neo-noir is having a resurgence of some description that we have noticed in the process of doing this podcast.
I don't know if it's a resurgence.
Well, okay, sure,
most of these films are 10 years old.
But it's just so, we think it's quite, you know, worth noting that noir is something that is accessible to everyone. If you have a camera, and you have some kind of light source, then you can make noir.
Well,
and if you can write a script, then you can make a really good noir.
Exactly.
And you need very minimal funds, and you've got a good film on your hands. Now, what do we have? We've got Chris Nolan with Following. That's his first film. That cost $7,000, and it's a really nice noir.
Yeah.
We've got
Darren Aronofsky
with Pi. That's a quite nice a noir there. We've got Rian Johnson with Brick. And what I think is probably the most unique... of the three.
Yeah, definitely.
And, well, in the sense that it is noir, but it is, you know, it's not monochromatic. Like, it is actually in colour, and it's, I think it's more...
And for 50,000, you know, I reckon if you really...
500,000. So, I mean, it was bigger than...
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that he came up with that figure, because I think, actually, if you really wanted to, you could have done this for less, but he went...
When you think about the locations and everything, that they really probably...
It paid off, and he doesn't waste a dime, but it's very interesting that he did push for that, not large budget, but, you know, considering it was sort of financed by friends and it was...
Well, I mean, I think that might have been misleading. I don't think it was just...
He started the finance process with friends, and then it got bigger and bigger, and, I mean, eventually he's casting...
And I think once you've got JGL on board, you know, you can push for different kind of people with bigger pockets and bigger hearts. But absolutely, I think that's something worth noting. And Sarah and I have decided to start writing our very own film on the neo noir basis, just for the sake of it.
This is what we've learned from
this
podcast. If you want to start making films now, your first one has to be neo noir. Do it.
Exactly right.
Anyway. Going back, so one of the main, I mean, there's lots to talk about in this film. One of the main traits that I really like in it is the brief breaks from this sort of fantasy world that's been created when you sort of expose the kids as kids. And my favourite example of this is when Brendan is sitting down with the pin, who's the head kingpin, who's this really scrawny guy, Lucas Haas.
Yeah.
He's meant to be disabled. Who wears a cape is very...
And has a cane.
Yeah. He's one of those classic sort of... except, you know, he has his drug meetings while his mum provides the juice.
Orange juice, yeah.
And he's sitting down with Brendan and he just says, "Have you read Tolkien?" Like, and usually if this was an ordinary noir film, the line would be, you know, you ever read Voltaire or, you know, you ever read something according to him. Life, but no, just the film comes to a screeching halt, and he says, "Have you read Tolkien?" And he goes, and Brendan says, "Sorry, wait, fucking what?" And the dialogue drops.
I don't know about screeching halt, but
well, no, but there is sort of the pretense of the film is dropped. It's like sort of Brendan is thrown off script, he's thrown off his quest, and suddenly he's just presented with this, "Have you read Tolkien?" And he's like, "Yeah," and he doesn't say anything deep about it. Says, "Yeah, the description's in it, really nice." And it goes nowhere.
Yeah.
And it's so childish and basic and sort of, it really just alludes without explicitly stating, you know, how undeveloped really they are as people. And of course, the more overt examples are just the little appearances of mums.
Absolutely. Yeah, that one thing though, I suppose, you don't see Brendan's mother at any point. I don't think.
No, you don't. You see Tug's mum?
No, I think you see the Pin's mum.
You see the Pin's mum, but I think, but he does say, you know, "We're crashing at my folks' place" when he wakes up in the Pin, in Tug's place.
Mm. Yeah, after he's just murdered. Oh, well, yeah, no, let's not say.
Yeah, that. We won't give that away.
We're on that. Yeah, but that's a good scene as well. That's a really good scene.
The murder.
Yeah.
Of someone. Yeah, and it's. In sharp contrast to Darren Aronofsky, who we recently just did a retrospective on, which probably is going to appear after this one because I want to coincide this podcast with the release of Looper.
Cool.
So not sure how that's going to play out, but that might be coming next week or it's just come out last week. Anyway, compared to that, Rian Johnson knows when he has to just pull back and let the story flow naturally, but when he wants to really add a sense of style and a sense of tricky camera work, and editing techniques, he throws it in there with
a sleight of hand.
He can. And whenever
that.
Actual murder is suggested, which, you know, sort of elevates the whole plot from just this quite superficial teenage romp.
Mm. And something else that I found really good was the score. And it was done by his cousin, which is, you know, a lot of the time with something
he's
like
no
that.
David Julia.
Bloody hell. But see, the thing is, a lot of the time, if, like, you can tell David Julian was Chris Nolan's mate, and he wasn't like, I need a composer, I'm going to get David Julian. He was like, "Oh, I need a composer, oh, I'll get Dave."
David Julian, he gets work.
Well, yeah.
Even if you don't like him, he does get work, so...
Sure,
unlike
but...
Unlike everyone else involved in that film.
A lot of people get work that I don't like, you know.
I know, I'm just saying, he's...
I'm not the arbiter of, you know,
he's
employment.
He's competent enough to be a professional anyway. Enough about David.
Sure, but anyway, this cousin of Rian Johnson, that's like, obviously to some degree it would have been like, I need a composer, I'll just get my cousin to do it. But he's really good, and the theme, like that... And with the theme, like, it sounds like a stick being rattled in a bottle of in different tunings, and you're like, that's so inventive and just fits so well. And it's so simple. It's like, it's just an E minor just playing like E, just strum the chord. That's it.
But there's a lot of different things. You get the piano.
Well, no, that's it. That's what really kind of stylizes it and puts it back in that kind of film noir kind of lexicon. Is that, you know, variations on the theme. And any time that I see a film that has a theme and then variations like, oh, well, let's do it with piano, let's do it with the guitar, let's do it with the clarinet, I just instantly just grin. I just get so excited because I'm just like, yes. Good, cool. And see, that to me, you know, that's...
But there was no Kronsky Quartet.
But, you know, just that kind of thing, for me, that's exciting. And see, that's different. It's just different kind of arrangements of the same thing. Like, there's no piano. Do-do, 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 do-do. Like, you know, I'm kind of talking like, you know, play that with
a
clarinet.
Exactly,
like
what you mean.
You know.
It's just very
accurate. See, and that just kind
of
instantly...
Which is really sort of film scoring 101.
Yeah, and it kind of just, for me, it goes back to what I think is the best theme ever for any film, which is the theme to 400 Blows, which is just absolutely I was kind of fucking ridiculous.
Because the music is a bit off kilter and it feels more peppy than it should be. And of course, my immediate light bulb that went off in my mind was The Third Man, which of course features that fucking weird. What's the weird
like mandolin or lute or something?
No,
like
it's a much more obscure instrument that just plays throughout.
And it's so chirpy, and you're just like, wait, what?
I reckon that's sort of.
I don't think the music in Brick is particularly chirpy.
It's not chirpy, but it's not quite as.
You're talking about like the really.
No, but it could be more overtly. Like you could have lots of deep.
Yeah, but that, I mean, that's not really. I think just the fact that it's minimal doesn't necessarily mean that it's.
No, I'm
mean,
not it's about minimalism. I'm talking about it's not as deep. It's not as sharp. It doesn't jump in when something dramatic happens. It's not done.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's because Rian Johnson's a good director, not a patronizing fuckwit. Like essentially. Well, I mean,
yeah, but Hitchcock does that, and he's not a patronizing fuckwit.
Well, I mean, yeah, okay, sure, but like the thing is,
the score is very good, and it's ever present, and it is memorable. But it is underplayed a bit.
I think it's of the time now that people are kind of getting a little bit more conscious of, oh well, this score's here, like just telling me how to feel in this position. So I think scores, it's more and more, it's getting more and more acceptable to have a more minimal score. I think that's particularly with directors like Michael Haneke, who's like no.
I don't think this is minimal though.
What with the score?
It's just not as overtly. It doesn't as overtly match the emotion.
I still think it's vital. I think it's absolutely it's vital.
I'm speaking
in the
minimalist
sense of like, you know, you don't need like strings like whenever like a door opens and there's a surprise. You don't need like a.
I'd say it's not as overtly matched to the emotions of the film as some. It's still just as memorable and as complex musically.
Yeah, no, that's not what I was.
It's not as tied to the. To the beats of the film, as say,
though with the climax, the actual climax scene in the Pins' house, that is so good,
and that actually is when the music amps up.
It really amps up, but it doesn't amp up in the classical way. It amps up very much in a way that is limited by the budget and by the resources, but just works so well. It sounds like. There's a drum beat in there that sounds like they're hitting a stick on a tin can. It just works so well. Yeah. And, I mean, like, it really... Like, I remember the first time I watched it in that scene, I was just like... Yeah! And then, you know. Yeah, that...
Yeah, and of course, actually, the biggest trend, really, in soundtracks at the moment, which this doesn't do, is having the ironic soundtrack. You show... I mean, Tarantino popularized this, and I'm just now seeing it everywhere. Breaking Bad does it heaps, is you put a sort of a retro... very chirpy pop song over scenes of horrific violence.
That's true.
That is the biggest trend, I reckon, now at the moment.
I think so, yeah.
We talk a lot about scores.
We don't... Well, I think they're very
They're valid. I just... Yeah. It's interesting that we've sort of done this. But anyway...
not deliberate at all. Just interesting and valid. But, you know... there is one point I want to address, and that is... it's basically my pet peeve with audiences who, you know... Okay, basically... I watched a review of Brick by.
I can't believe
okay,
you're
sure,
that.
Whatever,
okay,
whatever.
Go on,
but
go on.
There's this YouTube channel of a YouTube user called Go Ali Bongo, and she's got a really hot accent. And she's hot, so you know I watch them occasionally. But she did a review of Brick, and her main complaint was that it was too ambiguous, and that the relationships between the character and their dialogue. And this is a something she repeated throughout the whole thing. They had no ecological validity. No ecological validity.
And I
sorry, did you hear what I said? They had no ecological validity, and I was just like,
right, you're saying the validity of the ecological
wasn't valid. The validity of the ecological not didn't exist, and basically, just like it's like something out of a 20s detective movie, and you're like. Are you serious? Are you fucking kidding?
I like to.
Basically, I just like to address this. This is my kind of pet peeve, and this is the way I'll answer it. It's not a documentary. It's a film. It's not trying to be a documentary. It's not trying to be a John Cassavetes movie. It's a stylized. It's a noir. Noirs. If you come to noirs for a documentary, then you're in the wrong place. I mean, I personally would love to see that kind of new like genre of documentary making. Like, inside job, but noir. So, like, you do an interview with Alan Greenspan, but, like, he's in complete chiaroscuro. That'd be, I mean, you know, sure, but it's not what it's about. So people who say that the film doesn't make sense and teenagers don't act like this, and how did Brendan get up and keep fighting? Like, why did what you know, is driving him to do this? Shut up, basically. I mean, you know, like, sure, people have their own opinions and stuff, but you're watching the wrong thing, Brosephs and Brosephinas. Seriously, get over it.
I'd like to think that audiences in general are a bit more intelligent.
Yep.
And I just think that's such
that they can live in a world without ecological validity. That, okay, that personally is one of the main things I love about movies, is that, you know...
I mean, I think when we've done Aronofsky and Lynch and even Nolan to an extent, I think we would have been past this by now. We're kind of...
It's always going to be a battle. The battle will be forever ongoing.
Yeah, but I mean, this is really just beyond stylized, like, classic. I mean, noir always, it's not a fantasy genre. This is a sort of fantasy film. There's something self-kilter about the world. It, you know, to bring it back to our first, it has a Lynchian... Actually, speaking of Lynch and Brick, Lynchpin, the pin... Anyway... I was on Ryan Johnson's forum. Now, Ryan Johnson has his own forum. He's an awesome guy. And so you can just talk about Ryan Johnson's film and he will often reply.
Yeah, that is very cool.
He's a cool dude. Anyway, I was on his forum and someone started a post about, you know, were there influences on Brick from David Lynch, specifically Twin Peaks? And I can easily see that comparison because there is... It's not as overtly noir, but there's the detective mystery that centers around this high school, and without, well, at least at first, without giving anything away, that is overtly fantastic or mystical. Something's really off the entire way. That's his entire filmography. But Johnson said, "Oh yeah, definitely, both cool. consciously and subconsciously, I definitely would have stolen a lot from Lynch for this film."
Yeah.
Cool. And that really is kind of your first... I think you should probably know that going in. It's so obviously trapped in a world that's off-kilter. And my theory about the film is... I don't think this is the point it's trying to make. I think if it is trying to make a point, so to speak... I don't know if that...
Really noirs very seldom do in
yeah,
a way.
Yeah, in the way kind of I'm talking about. But one of the aspects I take away from the film is, and it's very similar to, you know, what Buffy was doing and what Veronica Mars later did, is the idea that the sort of... the mindset of high school students is such that their entire world takes on this really... over-the-top, good-evil battle quality to it that's extremely dark and melodramatic and has aspects of a fantasy world.
And from the outside, seems completely insignificant and ridiculous.
Which is you see when the mother just kind of treats these intense drug deals. And now, obviously, within... There's no sort of moment at the end, it was all in his head. No, it's not. It's not like that. It's not saying that overtly, but I think... what the film sort of does hint at to an extent is that this world is so askew because it represents the sort of solipsistic view of high school.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where it's so internalized and develops its own mythology that you build up, where you have
absolutely. And I don't think even in the sense that this is what you think you're doing the whole time.
Mm.
This isn't like, you know, you don't think, oh, I'm going to do a drug deal and then I'm going to go to my mates and avenge my girlfriend's death. I do not know why they are German, but and really weird anglicized German. But you know, the fact is that in terms of the effect it has on an audience, like, the dialogue is so quick fire, it's confusing, it's kind of a bit annoying at times, but the fact is that, you know, that can happen, but you're still going along with it.
And there are times when I think the dialogue becomes so over the top and on the nose, but that, yes, it is sort of self-reflexive and it is sort of making,
absolutely.
You go, hang on. There's something beyond just beyond the surface.
Yeah, it's not for a way of putting you exactly in the character's shoes, because they're dealing with it fine. They're very adept at dealing with this.
Yeah.
But the effect it has is that you're confused, but you're still very intrigued.
Yeah.
And you're still very invested, and you're just like, why the fuck is Brendan taking on the, you know, the whatever Brad, what's his face, the footballer.
Brad Burnham or something.
Yeah, the dickhead. Just like, why is, I don't understand. Like, why is he doing that? But, you know, that's just kind of playing
the logic
on,
yeah, of this universe.
Exactly. Like, you're just like, wait, why? Why is he doing that? Surely he'd, no, protect yourself, Brendan, get the fuck out. No, like, that's not what it's about.
Man,
you get confused,
I
and the dialogue, like, yeah. Yeah,
he
yeah,
shit
yeah.
Out of that guy. That
yeah.
was a satisfying moment.
Yeah.
But I think, and you know, I kind of said this before, and I'll say it again, and it's one of the reasons this film's so successful is it really gets the best of both worlds in that it kind of fully immerses you in the world that he's created, yet at the same time it makes you just aware enough to kind of step back and go,
yeah,
all right, there's something wrong here, so you get to experience it completely from within the
yeah.
character's mindset and the sort of myth they've constructed of high school, while also acknowledging the fact that it is actually a myth itself.
Mm.
So you get really
yeah.
the best of both worlds just on the one watch, which is a really
yeah.
tricky balance.
Yeah,
you don't need to finish it, go back, read the essays, rewatch it again, and kind of
yeah,
go,
no.
hang on, I think he's saying this. No, it's all
it's
really
just,
clear on first view, but
yeah,
it's
and
subtle
it,
enough.
But it is a thing that does reward multiple
oh,
viewings
yeah,
in
yeah.
a big way.
Yeah, yeah.
In a big way. But I mean, just my thing, my attitude to it that is just one of the reasons I have such great affection for is that he has the right attitude to stylization. It's not, oh, he's doing this and he's shooting this through the Venetian blinds, so that means this, and then this all means that, and you're not like ticking everything over,
yeah.
decoding everything as it's happening. It's a genuine kind of emotional
yeah.
like involvement. So it's like a Spielberg way movie in the way that it involves the audience. And To do that with stylization. And just for me, the kind of prime example of this is that the scene where Brendan is waiting for a response from the pin, and you don't know who it is, but he sees a man approaching and he's like, you got my answer? And you have no idea who this guy is or where he's come from. He gets out a switchblade, and then just this chase begins. And Brendan's wearing these shoes that are very, very, have a very specific sound, and this other
yeah.
guy's in this big black suit, and he's got very lumbering kind of big boots, like boo, boo, and Brendan's like da 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 da. And there's this one section where he's running down this straight, and then he turns a corner, and then he takes his shoes off, and then kind of just starts stumbling back. So he trips the guard, and you know, just that section where he's sprinting, and it's got the intensity, and they're building the whole time, and in the mix as well, the mix is being pushed up until it ends with this guy being
the
tripped
dong.
Over the dong at the end of
he
it.
He hits a pole.
I read this, Tina linked me to it, actually. Shout out to Tina. She linked me to this thing where Rian Johnson had said that he was a drummer, and Rian and JGL is a drummer, and the guy who was running also happened to be a drummer. So they were speaking this language
yeah.
where that entire sequence was supposed to be like an intensifying drum solo.
Yeah.
And that's not... That
it's not so overt, but you're like, hey,
yeah, exactly,
the drum solo
exactly,
shoe scene.
Exactly,
yeah.
And just in the way that kind of crescendos and really does build up to what is a very satisfying conclusion, and in a way that's also very, very low budget, like all you hear is the dong, and then just see the guy slumped around a pole, like, and I mean that for me was great, but just the fact that it was a very, very stylized, calculated thing
yeah.
that had an effect. But wasn't you going, oh, well, this sounds like a drum solo. Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Very, very nicely done. It's, whoa, this is getting intense. Like, oh, payoff. Cool. Great.
Yeah.
And that is the attitude to stylization in this film, and why I think it works so well. Because it's
we're
not
very much
ticking over.
By just looking at Aronofsky last time.
Yeah,
I think
I suppose.
That's... Coloring out
I mean, see, I'm not bothered. Like, it's not a general thing. I'm not like, oh, bloody films making me work to kind of discover a meaning. Like,
yeah.
I dig that. And when it's for the right film, it's a brilliant.
No,
it can be a brilliant thing. But that's not what this film is.
Yeah, no.
And the fact that it does involve you so much without you being aware, like, oh, this is why I'm involved, and this is the wheel that he's turning to get me to feel for this character at this certain time, or just understand this situation or be completely befuddled by this situation. Like, the thing is, like, it happens at such a breakneck speed that you can't even, like, even if you wanted to kind of decode everything to your utmost satisfaction, you couldn't.
Yeah, and also it's interesting when I sort of, when I watch this for the podcast, going, all right, got to keep an eye out for the various homages and the stylistic quirks and what he's doing and all of this. And I kind of was trying to think of something that really was clear and repetitive in the way he was doing it, but there wasn't. It really was organic, and it was very obvious that he was, that his directing was reacting to the script in really natural ways. And
the environment, the script and the environment.
Yeah, because, you know. And not in the sense that he's an amateur director who hadn't developed his style. No, it's nothing like that. He just wanted to tell the story organically while still being very skillful and very deliberate in his directing choices, which is really...
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. And there's you can tell he wrote it for where it was shot because it's his home, hometown. And apparently it's a very small kind
it's
of place, and it's
California,
yeah. And he wrote it for that place, so like very, very unique kind of places, like the arch where they meet and where he discovers the body. You know, like you couldn't write that in, really. You couldn't just like in the sense that you can't just like write that place and then go and find it. It was specifically written for that location. He thought, wow. Wouldn't it be great if somebody was dead there and somebody found them? Maybe I can write that into a film. Like, you know, you can tell. And I like seeing that when you can see that a specific location, which is where it's shot, which is where the action is set, is almost the location that inspired the action.
Yeah.
And that's another thing I love about a lot of, like, indie directors' kind of first films, because they're obviously very personal.
They really know
their locale stuff like that.
Very
yeah.
well. And another interesting thing also about this is the high school itself has this bizarre architecture, like the constant use of the drama group, which is massively overfunded. All right, so this is a public school, we assume. There's no way
they get that much money.
This drama department is getting this much money. Yeah. But this, of course, adds just to the great sort of stylized and very off-kilter effect of the whole film. So, you know, you're getting the Greek... You kind of see it.
The Commedia dell'arte kind of
you
with
see
the or with the well maybe not Commedia but
no the
but
Kabuki.
The
you see, it's there's the there's the Kabuki face paint, and then you get the shadows of I think they're doing a Greek tragedy, and you get the shadows of it playing against it.
Yeah.
So it's hyper stylized, even though it's contextually accurate to an extent. It does make sense within the film's logic.
And
that okay, he's in the drama department, but it's still very weird.
Yeah, and that is you know a strength and I think a little bit of a dip of the hat to the old kind of to the noir films of old, like the protagonist going into some place which is ridiculously detailed, like the set designers really had a fun time with that one, like just kind of making all these details, and he spots one little thing and he finds the invitation to the party and then he looks at it, and then I think it had her name on it or something. Oh, point is, he goes and grabs it, and you're just like in this whole room, like this one place that he shouldn't be, that he never goes to, and he gets his like one little thing, and you're just like, that's so such a wonderful appropriation that like in times of old it might be, you know, a prime suspect's house, and he'll kind of be rummaging through and like grab one thing and like, I've got you now, baby, and just like leave.
Yeah.
In the high school situation, it's the drama group, like the most obvious suspect and the most obvious offender.
It's like when you go to the sort of cabaret club in a noir film.
Yeah.
You know, now it's the drama department, and you meet the sort of the femme fatale.
Yeah.
And you know, I think also that sequence after it harkens very much. I don't know if it's deliberate, but it reminds me a lot of, you know, the technique they did a lot in Buffy and Veronica Mars.
Which one? The one when they at the party?
No,
at
when
Laura's?
He calls up to get the party, and he bullshits his way in. And I think this is a really interesting technique that you see in this and those shows, and perhaps even Donnie Darko or something. It's just when in high school, it's this fantasy world of, you know, you're so aloof and so detached from the social cliques that you can just really bullshit your way into the party because you know the tics so well. And I think that really plays to the fantasy.
Yeah, absolutely. And he just says all the right things, and he gets his way into all. And I mean, for me, that's...
And that's another one. Veronica Mars is just has down to a T.
Yeah. And see, I think that's why, you know, in some respects, a noir or something like that, well, particularly one like this, is in a way similar to an action film. Instead of, you know, with guns and kind of hiding behind anything that they can hide behind and shooting, and somehow shooting all the bad guys, and all the bad guys missing them constantly, you know, like, that's basically what an action film is.
Yeah.
And, you know, people say, you know, why couldn't they just, you know, kill the guy? And you're like, well, because there wouldn't be a fucking movie if they could, you moron. Like, that's the point. Like, and I think it's very similar to this. Like, oh, well, why didn't they realize that he was full of shit or something like that? Well, because that's the film. And I think it's actually kind of similar the way that, you know, they managed to kind of get themselves out of all these ridiculous situations. I find what Brendan kind of goes through to kind of bullshit his way into the pins in a circle is kind of similar to the way that, like, a lone gunman will kind of make their way up to this one guy who he wants to fight in an action film, in a way.
Yeah, well, another great example, which I just watched again on TV, of using, which is a literal example of this in sort of, well, it's not high school, Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's obviously much more on the nose, but an interesting example where it's literally, you know, you're fighting your way in a video game to the head boss.
That's a good film,
actually, that one.
I do like Edgar Wright, so.
Well, I just rewatched it, and it is very good.
Yeah. I think the thing is that, I don't know, I mean, I kind of find watching action films to be a far more frustrating experience than, you know, than something like this, because the idea, well, I kind of find them to be similar. I was kind of like, this is kind of like an action film in the improbability of everything that's happening. But I find it much more exciting to watch a guy kind of lie and put on a facade that, you know, will serve him well than watch someone shoot a bunch of people.
Yeah, well, that's the classic dichotomy of noir versus, or detective stories versus, you know, regular crime story. But yeah, well, whatever. I'm pretty, don't really care.
Yeah.
I don't have any true genre allegiances or dislikes.
See, that's
except
the thing.
Maybe,
yeah,
fantasy.
I do. I mean, it depends who does it.
I know.
Any genre done wrong will be shit, and any genre done right will be good.
Yeah, I agree.
So, you know, there's no like specific thing. I do like my psychological thrillers, but I've seen a fair few terrible ones, like The Machinist. That is fucking abysmal.
Oh, that's Skinny Bale.
Skinny Bale. Fucking terrible movie.
Anyway, we're getting off.
I think we're kind of.
We should probably sign off.
Yeah, probably. So. All right,
thanks for listening to Brick. And you can go see Looper in cinemas September 27th.
Definitely do it. Really excited for that. I'm not sure. We'll be different everywhere. I'll be in. Oh, yeah, I'm leaving the country tomorrow. Yay.
Oh,
yeah,
I think we mentioned that. On the
yeah, I'm going to Berlin. I'll be on a plane in, like 22 hours.
Yeah, hey. So Christian's going to be gone. We've stockpiled podcast. Well, hang on.
We'll kind of be offline for about 2 weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
We might do the Skype cast. We don't know. We'll see.
It might also be my TV cast.
Oh, that's true. That could
yes,
be good.
Yes, examining could a good season of television in the same way we would a film. And now that we've mentioned it, I'm interested to go back and have a look at Veronica Mars. Very interesting series.
That could be cool.
Yes.
It sounds really far up my alley.
So the two television series, nice little segue from this. First of all, similar ideas, Veronica Mars, go watch it. And same director, Breaking Bad, go watch it right now if you haven't. It's one of the best things on television, and, you know, beyond, I don't even think I would do an episode on it. I'd start my own fucking podcast. That is an amazing show. We've got 8 episodes left next year. Catch up.
We're hoping to live cast that as
well. Yeah, we Christian's going to get caught up, and then we may do a retrospective on each season per episode, and then to coincide with the release of the second part of season 5, which we will then live cast. Well, not literally live, but, you know.
Like, no.
That'd be kind of fun.
That would be fun, but it'd be stupid as hell.
Like commentating. Yeah, no, I wouldn't do that. So anyway, those are a few things that we might do. If you like us, rate us on iTunes, review us on iTunes, download us on iTunes, download us on Podomatic, leave a comment on Podomatic, email us at cavaliersdocinema@gmail.com.
And tell all your friends.
And keep watching the sky.
Keep listening to the... No, reach for the stars! Stars may contain traces of asbestos.
It doesn't make any sense. anything.
Yeah, no, it really doesn't.
So, you know.
That was an in-joke, everybody.
Yeah.
But yeah, we are really rambling, so I think, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, you guys know how to support podcasts, do the stuff that we love, make us happy, make Crippy smile.
Mm.
He's smiling, it's very cute. Mm. And we'll be back next week, depending on what order we upload it, either Aronofsky or something that just we haven't thought of yet.
Yeah,
right,
okay.
Haven't thought of yet.
Maybe. So, yeah.
Thank you very much for listening. Go see Looper and...
Have a good one.
Have a good one.